Welcome to the CSIS Cogitasia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Colm Quinn. As always, we'll start with the region's news. In Washington, US and Chinese officials wrapped up discussions on key issues in global affairs and the bilateral relationship at the seventh round of the Strategic and Economic Dialogue. Leaders on both sides indicated progress was made on important issues in advance of President Xi Jinping's upcoming visit to the US this fall. However, no major deliverables came out of the talks. In Tokyo, Japan's military may join US naval forces in patrolling the South China Sea, according to Japan's chief of the Joint Staff of the Self-Defense Forces, Katsutoshi Kawano. He said China's island-building campaign has created concerns for the country, and although Japan didn't have plans to conduct surveillance in the South China Sea, it may now consider doing so. Japan and the Philippines flew joint air patrols near disputed areas in the sea this week as part of a search and rescue drill. South Korea reported 3 new cases of Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS, on Tuesday, but no additional deaths. The total number of people diagnosed with the disease in Korea came to 175, according to the Ministry of Health and Welfare, while the country's death toll remained at 27. 2 of the new patients were already in isolation as suspected cases, but the source of infection for the third was unclear. Australia's government will contribute $720 million to China's new Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, or AIIB, as a founding member. Treasurer Hockey said the bank will provide massive opportunities for Australian companies and enhance connectivity to the region. In economic news, global rice production looks set to take a hit as the Asia-Pacific braces for the most severe instance of the El Niño weather pattern in over a decade. Forecasters are expecting a 40% increase in wholesale prices as droughts in major producing countries such as Thailand and India are expected to result in severely curtailed yields. Rice is a staple food worldwide, particularly in Asia, on top of which rice cultivation is the primary source of income for almost 1 billion households in Asia, Africa, and the Americas. Small-scale farmers account for about 80% of global rice producers and often have little in terms of safety nets or alternative income sources. And that wraps up our news for this week. The US Congress approved Trade Promotion Authority this week, setting up the final stage of negotiations for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. Senior Fellow for the Sumitro Chair in Southeast Asia Studies Murray Hebert and Executive Director of the Asia Trade Center in Singapore Deborah Elms sat down to discuss various paths forward on trade in the region.
Hi, my name is Murray Hebert from the Southeast Asia Program at CSIS. My guest today is Deborah Elms, who's the Executive Director of the Asia Trade Center in Singapore. Thanks for joining us, Deborah.
Thank you.
So there are, besides the ASEAN Economic Community, there are 2 big trade negotiations that involve Southeast Asia. The Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, the so-called RCEP, which involves the countries that have free trade agreements with ASEAN countries, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which includes 4 ASEAN members. How well do you think, considering, are these negotiations going, and what are the major hurdles in one or both of those?
Well, I'll start with the TPP first, since that's going to be more familiar, I assume, to most of your audience. You know, obviously, we're in the middle of the arguments here in Washington over the authority to negotiate the TPP, but once that hurdle is passed, assuming it gets dealt with soon, the negotiations are, I think, quite close to being done. In other words, I think once TPA is in hand, you have 2 weeks worth of furious negotiating, culminating in a ministerial meeting in which the trade ministers make the final political decisions, and we'll have a TPP finished. But they've been at this for more than 5 years. They know more or less where the difficult issues are, and most of them, I think, have been resolved, or at least everyone knows where the resolution lies. So we're down to really a handful of issues that are difficult. So Canadian dairy, for example, American sugar, some more complaints about specific issues in intellectual property rights, how many entities can be listed under state-owned enterprises, a bit on labor and the environment, especially in the wake of this TPA disaster in Washington. I suspect that those chapters will be up for review again. So there's just a few issues that have to be resolved, but there's a lot of commitment to get it done. So TPP, very close to being done. Most of the sensitive issues are dealt with. We're down to the last few. In RCEP, they just held their eighth round of negotiations in Kyoto last week. RCEP is not a TPP. It's often described as a TPP competitor. It's not. It is a mega-regional agreement that brings together 16 parties in Asia. But it is not trying to be anywhere near as ambitious as the TPP. And as an example, let me just give you the number of chapters. TPP is 29 chapters. RCEP is likely to end up at, say, 10, 11, 12, somewhere in there. So it's not trying to cover all of the kinds of difficult issues that the TPP is trying to cover. That said, the advantage of RCEP is that it will link together parties in Asia that have not previously been linked together, especially what ASEAN likes to call its dialogue partners or its foreign partners, China, Japan, Korea, India, Australia, and New Zealand. So when those partners get together, even if it's a relatively low quality agreement, low quality meaning not a lot of market opening, there is still a lot of potential for businesses. So I think that RCEP is worth paying attention to. Even if it turns out to not be as exciting as the TPP, there are some real market opportunities, especially if firms work hard to articulate their demands or their needs to different government ministries. I think that you'll have a much better RCEP at the end of the day.
So how the TPP and the RCEP could be done in the next year or so, at least theoretically. Has Asia started to think about what comes next? Might there be an opportunity to hook these two agreements together at some point, or what comes next in the trade space?
It's a good question. I think RCEP's deadline is at the end of this year. They will not make the end of this year, and if they did, it would be really a disaster for the agreement because it will be incredibly bad in order to reach that deadline, and they'll split it into two parts. They'll do part one, which will be goods or goods and services, and then part two, everything else, most of the things actually of interest to American business in particular. That would be bad. So I think RCEP has at least another year to run and possibly further. There is discussion that these two agreements are both pathways to the FTAP, the Free Trade Area of the Asia Pacific in APEC. And you hear a lot that these two have to merge at the end of the day, but I think this is a disaster because in order for them to merge, two things have to happen and neither one of which seems plausible to me. The first is that the TPP members will drop down to some level closer to RCEP. And most of those TPP members will say, why would we do that? We already have a high quality, high standard agreement. We don't want to reduce the level of coverage or reduce the depth of the agreement in order to sign something else. So the rest of you should come up to the level of the TPP. But for the members of RCEP who are not in the TPP, they will say, wow, that's too ambitious. If we wanted to be in the TPP, we would have joined the TPP. So we don't want to go to that level either. So neither one of those parties, groups of, you know, are going to want to move. And then there's a third, in my view, major problem with the FTAP model using these two pathways, which is there are a number of countries that are in neither one of those agreements, including for APEC, Russia, Papua New Guinea, and Taiwan. So they will be essentially handed an agreement in which they had zero role in playing in developing either one of them. And to me, that is unfair and inappropriate. If you want to make an FTAP with 21 members of APEC, then I think you need to start from the beginning with the 21 members of APEC and say, what is it that we actually want to accomplish? And that, frankly, I think I will be long gone before we get anywhere close to the FTAP, because those are 21 very diverse economies with very diverse interests. I don't see how they're going to get to any sort of useful agreement in my lifetime.
Deborah Elms, Executive Director of the Asian Trade Center in Singapore, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And that was Deborah Elms. We turn now to U.S.-Vietnam relations. The two old enemies are moving toward unprecedented cooperation with the pending visit of the Vietnamese Communist Party General Secretary to D.C. in early July and the possibility of a visit by President Obama to Hanoi later this year. In building up the relationship, a key element has been the effort by the United States to assist the Vietnamese government in the removal of unexploded ordnance in the region and in treating patients and children affected by the toxic dioxin chemicals in Agent Orange, which was deployed to kill vegetation during the Vietnam War. This week, CSAS hosted Senator Patrick Leahy, who led an effort to treat persons in Vietnam affected by Agent Orange. After the speech, my colleague Ernie Bauer spoke with Tim Reeser, clerk on the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on State, Foreign Operations and Relations Programs, about how the U.S. Congress funded this humanitarian program, crucial to building trust in the relationship.
Where is the resistance, and what would you recommend to President Obama that he do in relation to this issue if he visits Vietnam this November, as may be in the works?
So I'm not sure the president will be asking me for my advice, but I...
That's the fun.
I can say that, you know, initially it was difficult for the reasons that the senator said, that the lawyers at the State Department and the Pentagon were very resistant to the idea of any kind of action by the United States that might be interpreted as being reparations or compensation or anything like that. And that's nothing new. It's just consistent with tradition. And so it took over a year to reach agreement with them that what we were talking about was not either of those things. It was really about trying to work with the government of Vietnam and others in Vietnam to address a problem which we obviously had responsibility for in a way that was going to help further our relations with Vietnam and also was fundamentally a humanitarian effort. And it wasn't a legal issue. It wasn't about admitting some legal liability. It wasn't reparations. It was rather providing training and other assistance and other forms of environmental remediation to help both Vietnam, but also further our relations with Vietnam. And it actually took quite a while to overcome the resistance of the institutions. There's just a natural institutional inertia to things such as this. But once we did, then the other issue, he alluded to one, which was the fact that there's not been established a causal, scientifically proven causal connection between exposure to Agent Orange and the kinds of disabilities that we're all familiar with in Vietnam. And so we also had to make the point that we didn't really think it was necessary. That the point was that we had been involved in supporting programs to assist people in Vietnam who were clearly victims of war injuries for years. And we wanted to expand those programs in areas where Agent Orange had been sprayed or where there were serious concentrations of dioxin contamination because we believed that it was quite likely that many of those people had been exposed to Agent Orange or had or were the offspring of people who had been. Plus, of course, the fact that we were compensating American veterans for this same type of exposure, it seemed, as the senator described, to be an obvious double standard, and that the arguments that had been made to us really didn't hold water, given that we were providing assistance to our own veterans. So that whole process, that whole discussion, took quite a while to get past. And then the issue became one which was simply financial. There was no money in the budget. It's not like the administration has ever actually designated funds specifically for this purpose. You know, if every year the president releases his budget, all the things that he wants the Congress to fund, and we do our best to try to address his priorities, and we also obviously have members of Congress who have their own, not to mention others outside the government who have an interest in the work of the government and how funds are appropriated. But in this case, we have had to find the money. And because it's a zero-sum game in the appropriations process, if you take money from one place, or to get money from one thing, you have to take it from somewhere else. So we've basically had to steal money over the years from different places to fund this program. It's not like the administration has budgeted for it. And so that has been difficult also. And it's why it has been a very incremental process. Every year, we find $25, $30 million from whatever source I can I can dig around for. And that is how we have worked our way over the years, incrementally, to the point where we now have budgeted over $130 million, as was mentioned. But we have quite a ways to go. The Bien Hoa Airport is, we expect, more heavily contaminated than Da Nang. And it's why the Senator mentioned we've urged the Pentagon to also contribute to this effort. After all, they had a lot to do with this. And they should, he feels, recognize that it's in our interest to, that they are working with the Vietnamese military to try to address it. So, you know, we have to plan for the future. We have to, ideally, if the President would include money in the budget, it would make our lives much easier. But at the very least, to when there are opportunities, if the President goes to Vietnam or when the General Secretary comes here, to reinforce and reaffirm the commitment of both countries to continuing to work together on these issues, that's almost as important as providing the funds to do so.
And that was Tim Reeser. Our one to watch this week is the pangolin, a rare mammal with an armor of scales being employed by the USAID Regional Development Mission for Asia in its efforts to combat wildlife trafficking. Native to Southeast Asia, pangolins are prized for their meat and scaly armor, particularly in China and Vietnam. According to the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, the pangolin is critically endangered because of extensive hunting to meet demand. Advancing efforts to combat wildlife trafficking was one of a number of topics discussed this week between US and Chinese officials during the Strategic and Economic Dialogue. Support from Chinese government remains key to preserving endangered species in Asia, including pandas, sharks, rhinos, and elephants used for food, decoration, or medicinal purposes. Two relative success stories have been Xi Jinping's ban on luxury meals, such as shark fin soup, and China's extensive spending to conserve wild pandas. Will the pangolins join them as another success story, or will they go extinct? Here at CSIS, we're rooting for the region's governments to step up. And that's our show for this week. You can always find more at cogitasia.com and csis.org. Also, check out our island tracker and maritime-specific analysis on the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative, or AMTI, microsite. I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.